Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses, and I do it for an audience of real entrepreneurs. And I'm going to be open with you guys. I remember when I was a kid, aspiring to be an entrepreneur, I remember hearing that Howard Hughes was addicted to something that gave him more speed, that let him work through the night. Was it Howard Hughes or Hugh Hefner? I think it might have even been both of them. Frankly, it was a handful of entrepreneurs who had that. And in my head, I said to myself, I'd be willing to make that trade-off. If I could take a drug that would make me work harder through the night, I'd be absolutely willing to do it. Yeah, my health would suffer, but you know what? Life makes your health suffer. I'd be willing to do it. Turns out that I don't have my biology doesn't allow me to get into drugs. It's just not my thing. But it's a good thing that it's not, because it turns out that it's not some kind of superpower, at least according to Michael Dash's experience. He is an entrepreneur who built an HR company called Parallel HR Solutions, grew it. We'll find out how big he got it. And along the way was addicted to Adderall. Adderall is speed. Am I right, Michael?
Basically.
Cocaine does make you feel more powerful?
It did.
Did. Right. And then gambling makes you feel like, well, the world is kind of blah if it's just like waiting for a paycheck. Gambling makes you feel like, boom, I could actually have my big payday. All those things are the things that I thought would be temptations for me. They weren't. I do believe that there is an issue in entrepreneurship where, because we're so under the gun, because we are the types of people who want to get much more out of life than I think most people do, that we are more prone to addiction. We are more prone to taking on addictions without recognizing that we are, because we feel like, well, we're living big anyway. This is just a little thing for us. For other people, it might be a big problem. For us, it's just a little thing. Anyway, I want to talk about it. Most entrepreneurs will not talk to me about it here. They will talk to me about it in private. Michael Dash is willing to do it, so we're going to talk to him about that, and we're going to talk to him about his book, which he has on his shirt. Michael, what does the shirt say? There it is. Chasing the High.
Chasing the High.
Man, you are built too. All right. This interview is sponsored by, there's the book too. This interview is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors that you have not heard me talk much about, but I will be bringing up. The first, if you are onboarding people in your company, if you want everyone on your team to actually be working on the same, in the same way, have them all organized, you need to create a good training manual for them. Trainual will do it for you. I'll talk to you about that later. And if you have a second in command, you need to send them over to the COO Alliance. That is where they could get the type of training, camaraderie, and mentorship that they need to help you lead your company right. But I'll tell you about the COO Alliance later and Trainual later. First, I got to ask Michael the most pressing question, which is, at your height, how much revenue were you doing?
We're doing $5.5 million a year.
And how much of that did you get to keep?
How much did I get to keep?
Yeah.
Interesting question. I think that year I took home about
$350,000.
I think so in that okay. year. And then my partner took home $350,000 also. So I had a partner at the time. I believe that's what it was. Now, at the same time, we were running all our expenses through the company. So if we
like what?
I mean, like everything. Travel, we had offices in India, in New York, and in Utah, and in Idaho at the time. So wherever we would travel, any dinners, any expenses, any time out, you know, really pushing the envelope as much as we could, but relegating it to business expense.
But really, it's part of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Cars, so cars, you know, not obviously our mortgage, but, you know, part of your house you can claim as an office. So we would do that. I would work from home a lot as well. So anything we could do legally, we did.
Debbie, I think you're asking what type. We've got a live audience here for today. And Debbie's asking, I think, what type of business is Michael running? And it was an HR business, which he sold. We're going to get into all of it. I don't want to make this out into like a sad sack story. You've had a good life with some big challenges. Give me like the high. How fun was it? So we understand. Give me like, was there one night out? Was it strip clubs? Was it cocaine? Was it something else? I hear like my sponsors right now saying, why am I sponsoring Mixergy? But it's going to get into meaningful stuff, guys.
Yeah. So just to correct you real quick, it wasn't an HR company, although HR was the name of the company.
It was a recruiting company.
A recruiting staffing company, which are completely, they're a bit different. But yeah, I mean, no, there wasn't one night. There were many nights.
Give me one night. Like just describe one, even if it's
So I'll describe how sick it was, okay? I mean, do you want the fun or do you want the sick?
Give me the fun because we will get into the sick.
Were trips to Vegas, you know, gambling all night, you know, strippers, clubs, bottle service, you know, just standing on tables, you know, with champagne, spraying it all over the place.
Literally spraying champagne on people.
Literally spraying in pool parties at Wet Republic down in Vegas. You know, at the time I was into all the dancers and strippers and all that nonsense. And just completely surrounded by people who could really give two craps about you. But at the time you think they're the coolest people in the world and you're friends with them. And they're just around you because you have money and drugs.
So, and why did you want that? What was it for you? I feel like for me, I would want just the sense of big without having to earn it. Like the work every day to get big enough that people reflect back to me how important I am. It's a lot of work and a lot of time. But going out and partying and having everyone feel like I am the big man in the room, that's a quick hit. And that makes me feel good. What is it for you?
I mean, I'm just an adrenaline junkie. So, and I like to be the center of attention. So though that's a lethal combination when you put the two of those together.
Well, why do you feel like you need to be the center of attention? Do you ever do the work to understand what it is with you?
I like to be on stage. I like to be interviewed, you know, this interview right now, right? Yeah. I mean, I wrote a book, right? Not because I'm proud of everything that I've done, but I wrote the book really because I want others to learn. But just, you know, I was just on Fox last week. I mean, I love being a person of influence and I like being the funny guy in the room. I like people laughing at me. I like making people have a good time and like I want to be around Michael. Like that's the type of person I am. So that's what I like.
I get that. You are working in New York City in sports advertising. Your best friend came to you with an idea for career change. What did you say?
So I was working the first 4 years out of college. I went to University of Maryland, then I started working in New York City. I was doing sports advertising where we were basically on the phones 12 hours a day. So I was pounding the phones and I was really good at it, but I hated my boss. So, because he was a bookie, big gambling guy, and I had a bad gambling addiction then, and it was, and cocaine, and it was fueling everything, and he was not a good person. So, he would like turn employees against each other to get them to work harder, to hate each other. It was like crazy what he would do.
And that didn't work.
No.
Because?
Well, I mean, I remember one time he brought me into his office and he asked me my opinion of certain employees. So I'm a truthful person. So I told him. The next thing I know, he's marching those very employees into his office to tell them what I just told him about them.
Yeah, man.
I'm like, what an MF-er. Like, what are you doing, dude? And like, so now I have a poisonous relationship with these people who I had a positive relationship with. And that's just the most uncomfortable environment to work in ever. So I learned early on, you know, what the real world was about because I was a naive kid at that time.
And you thought you know what? I'm going to be open with you. I went to Glassdoor to look at reviews of what you were like as a boss back when you were running your company. They were not good. We're going to get into that later. But right now in this part of the story,
little teaser you're throwing out there.
Yeah, man. It's exactly it. You know where I'm going. So you didn't like your boss. Your best friend comes to you and says,
well, I told my best friend, I'm like, look, I'm quitting. Like, I hate this dude. Like, he's a piece of crap. You know, I can't deal with this. I was making good money, more money than all my friends at the time, too. But I was just like, I got to get out of here. So he's like, why don't you come work for me? He was working at a staffing company at the time. He was like the president of the company. He's like, come work for me, be my director of business development. We will crush it together. And I'm like, all right, cool. So I did it. You know, I knew him since I was 5 years old, trusted him a lot. We were both kind of same mentality, except he didn't do drugs and didn't have addictions like I did. But in terms of business, we always wanted to be successful. We wanted to run our own show, all of that stuff. So that's what we did. And I went and I worked for him and I built up about a $4 million book of business in 4 years.
Doing what for him? How do you do that?
So I was doing staffing. So similar to what my company was, but I was doing more of administrative support services and retail salespeople. So we would basically staff executive assistants for, a maternity leave. So it was all like temp stuff, all temp.
No, and no, so no, when you say you were doing a $4 million book, is that right?
I built a $4 million book of business. I started with nothing, knocked on doors.
You calling up local retailers? Sorry, you were about to say, what did you do?
Yeah, I called up, all companies. So, you know, my strategy is always, okay, what's working? Let me leverage that. So he was doing a lot in the hospital arena. So I started calling, you know, other hospitals up to try to pitch services, but I just hit everything I could. And so I hit retail shops, I hit banks, I hit financial services, and I ended up with clients in the retail sector. Metropolitan Museum of Art was a big client of mine. Bergdorf Goodman was a big client of mine. And then Bank of New York, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. So I was working
and they were paying you guys to place temps in for them. What were you doing that made you so good? Give me a tip. Let me learn from you.
I mean, I could sell ice to an Eskimo.
How? What's your thing that lets you do it?
My father was a salesperson, so I was born to an entrepreneur. So I learned he had an import-export business and a retail store selling fine china and collectibles. If you're familiar with Swarovski, Lalique, Baccarat, Waterford, all these fancy
things. He would sell that.
He sold that. So
you say in your book that you followed him around. I feel like some of what he had rubbed off on you. What did you see that he did especially well?
So he was a tireless worker. He busted his ass. He started the company in the house, grew it in the basement, then grew it outside, had one store, then two stores, then two companies, then three companies. So all tied around the same thing. So I learned work ethic at an early age. He was the typical, like, first one in, last one out. That's how you're successful. So that's how I learned. Now, I don't preach that. I'm sorry?
And that's what you did when you were starting to work for your friend, the recruiter.
That's what I did until the last couple of years, where I've started to kind of try to work smarter versus working harder. But that wasn't in my DNA. I was always just the work harder guy. Mm-hmm. And I would always outwork people. And that's how I was successful.
I'm going to come back to that in a moment. So you were working for him, you were doing really well, and then somebody came to you with an offer that had to do with Utah. What was this? Was this E-Trade?
Well, basically, nobody came to me. I was making outbound sales calls.
Yep.
E-Trade had an office in Jersey City. I was in New York City. I called E-Trade to see if I could provide them staffing solutions. The woman said to me, "We don't have any business here, but we are massively expanding in Utah. We're looking to hire 200 financial service reps, Series 7 and 63 licensed in 3.5 weeks in Sandy, Utah. Do you happen to know anybody out there? Can you help us?"
So why didn't you go to your friend and say, "Listen, I just got this great opportunity in Utah. Let's expand to Utah. We're going to make some good money and I'm going to be the person to lead it."
The owner of the company didn't want any business that wasn't in the New York, New Jersey area, in the metropolitan area.
Why do you think?
I have no idea. I could care less. I didn't care at the time. You know, I think he just wanted, you know, that's where he's from. He was just comfortable there and he wanted to build it and sell it. I mean, that's what I understood. But at the time I was like, I don't care. Like I have this great opportunity. I'm an entrepreneur at heart, and majority of salespeople are entrepreneurs, right? You're building your own book of business. You are a mini entrepreneur within a company, right? And that's how I viewed it. And I always knew I would run my own company. So at that point, I was like, well, there's no way I'm letting this opportunity pass, especially because it's in Utah. I knew one person outside of the metropolitan area in staffing. She was in Utah. We had worked previously together for 1 year in New York City before I joined my best friend in staffing. And she was very good on the technical side of things. I was very good on sales. So we had done a bunch of deals together. So it was a good combination because—
What do you mean by the technical side of things?
So at the time, I was doing technology staffing. So I took a job for 1 year so I could learn the staffing industry outside of my joining my friend. I didn't want to have to learn on his dime. So I joined with another company. So I worked for them for 1 year. Then 9/11 happened. Then she went back to Utah. Then I went and joined my friend.
So you got to tell people about, you get into this first recruiting company. They tell you, "Do you know how to use a computer?" You say, "Sure." Talk about how you turned the computer on or tried to.
Oh, that's really embarrassing. Thank you. So I hadn't used a computer. Like, I went to college and yeah, they had computer courses there, but I basically cheated my way through them. And I took this job selling sports advertising. We had a phone and we had index cards. That's how we did the whole business. So I didn't touch a computer for 4 years out of college. Then I go to this company, and the first day of work, I'm hitting the disk eject button, trying to turn the computer on. And I turn to my boss, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, I don't mean to sell anybody out, but they didn't set my computer up properly. Like, I can't turn it on. And he's like, try again. And I'm like hitting the disk eject button. He's like, are you kidding me? He's like, that's the disk eject button. Hit the power button. And at that point, like he told me later, like he was wondering why in the hell did I hire this guy?
And so when you're going in and recruiting in the tech area, and I know it wasn't all like, it wasn't developers or things like that that you were hiring, but no, you were in a tech environment. How does partnering up with someone else? Sorry?
It was developers.
It was developers in the beginning, yeah. Or we're talking later on?
In the first year was tech. Then I went to admin staffing for 4 years. Then I went back to tech.
So then how the hell are you recruiting tech developers when you don't even know how to turn a computer on?
Well, that's why I made a great partnership with this other woman. She did the recruiting. I did the sales. So I would go to the companies like Bear Stearns, which imploded and with the financial meltdown. They were a big client of mine, and Sony Music was a big client of mine. And I had, you know, several other clients, and basically I would go and I would pitch them the staffing services and let them know we could fill any of these jobs. And like, my, you know, I have the best technical resource on the planet. Like her husband is an architect. She knows development inside and out. Give us an opportunity. I would get the opportunity. She would fill it with the candidate. Bada boom, bada bing.
Got it. So now you're in Utah, taking a little break from your day job, doing this thing where you're going to place a bunch of people for E-Trade. And how were you able to do it? How were you able to place so many people?
So she was with a staffing company at the time. So I pitched her. I said, look, I got this amazing project. You know, do you want in on it? And she's like, yeah. And I said, okay, great. I'll manage it from the business side and you fill all the jobs. Okay. So I'll get one of your people or you on site at the facility. So you can interview people there. And if they pass our interview, then we hand them right off to HR and then they can pass their interview and we can get them hired right away. We need to do this quick. So she had a team. We pulled a team together of like 10 other recruiters. I took 30% and 70% gave it to them and I managed it. And then we pulled off filling all 200 positions within 3.5 weeks. And from that, we got projects in Alpharetta, Georgia, Jersey City, and Tampa, Florida. And in 1 year, we filled 800 financial service positions for E-Trade. Meanwhile, I had my other business and my other $4 million book of business that I was running too. I still haven't made that much money till this day that I made in that 1 year.
How much money do you think you made back then?
It was like $500-$600.
$500-$600. Meanwhile, your addiction, how is that going? How is it playing itself out?
Oh, I was just a crazy person. I mean, I ran a chaotic life. It was all, so that speed I'm talking about with the staffing, like when the day was over, I still needed that. I needed to fill my life with something.
You're
like
saying
that.
You would work really hard, pounding the phone, talking to your clients. And I remember also, well, I guess this is going to come later. You're doing all that. And then at the end of the day, when like 8, 9 o'clock, you'd leave the office and then go out and party?
Yeah. I'd probably meet some of the recruiters out. I'd buy everybody drinks. I'd do whatever. You know, we'd go to a club. Whatever.
By the way, Michael, I was in Utah. The ClickFunnels people invited me out to interview Russell Brunson in Utah. It was a wonderful place. I don't think of it as a party place. A lot of places don't even have alcohol. How are you partying in Utah?
You open your own bar. So that's what I did.
You opened a bar in Utah?
Yeah.
Where clients can come in and buy drinks and the whole thing?
Yeah. Well, not just clients, but yeah. Yeah.
Customers, I mean. So it wasn't like a home bar. We're talking about a real bar and people would come into your place.
Yeah, no, I went in with two other guys and it was like a bar club. And it was like the most fun I had in Utah when I moved. Like 2 years. It didn't last long because the two guys I got in bed with, figuratively, one of them had a drug problem, the other had a gambling problem. So it's apropos, like that's how my life is. And they pilfered the company from all the money that was in there. So it shut down within like a year and a half. But it was one of the most fun years of my life.
Because what happens when you get to own a place?
you get free reign, man. I mean, I was doing pulling people out of line, going into line, pulling the hottest girls out of line. Yep. You know, come on, you know, you want to come in? Yeah, I got you. You know, buying them shots, picking up their tabs, doing whatever.
Dating them too.
Yep, dating them.
Taking them home.
Of course, yeah, I lived across the street. It was a perfect setup. Wow.
All right, perfect setup. And so what kind of work were you able to do at the end of that? After going out and partying like that, the next day, how are you even able to function?
Popping Adderall.
What does Adderall do, actually? I kind of had a sense that it was speed.
It's like cocaine in a pill, basically. I mean, so Adderall is, if you have ADHD or ADD, you know, the medical industry will give you Ritalin or Adderall. Like Adderall is very prevalent these days.
To help you focus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Now I could get a ton of work done, but at the same time, it affected my mood tremendously. I would have mood swings and the way I would snap at people, I would cut them off. I wouldn't hear them out. It took away like the person that I really was, and it fueled the angry side of me. But I did get a lot of work done. There definitely is that side to it. Like if you need to clean an entire house or clean an entire garage or something, pop an Adderall and that will get done.
Wow. And so that's why you just kept taking on more work, because you said, all right, another pill is going to help me do it and do it myself. And you weren't very good with people. So you weren't good at delegating, structuring, and passing the work on.
I was good with people, but not on Adderall. Like on Adderall, I wasn't great leading people because I was just like, let's just get the shit done. Like, this isn't rocket science. We're staffing people for companies. Come on, get the shit done. Show up on time. Come to work on time. Leave when you're done. You know, put in extra time when you need to. Don't give me all this bullshit excuse. Like, I don't want to hear it. The client doesn't care. I don't care. So that was my attitude. And it permeated in a negative manner, you know, when I fully took, through most of running the company.
Well, we're going to talk about it again. I saw some of this online. Let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor. It's a company called Trainual. Michael, you're going to love this. I'm someone too who just needed to do everything myself because, you know, I feel like I could do everything. I've got natural energy. I was one time you ran a marathon, right? I ran this marathon for them. I ran one in Mongolia. At the end of the day, I call up my brother. I'm like all jacked up with full on energy. So I've finished my marathon. I go explore Mongolia. I call my brother with full on energy. And he goes, this is just you, like not even caffeine or anything. No, not even caffeine. I don't have caffeine beyond that first cup of coffee, usually in the morning. And so I feel like I could do it all. The problem for me and my company was I couldn't keep on doing it all. And then I had to start, like if I wanted to grow, I had to start bringing people in. And then I expected them to just understand stuff. I'd say, okay, look, you need to edit my videos. It's not that tough. You just sit down, you edit, chop, chop, move it on, and that's it. They couldn't edit the video. I'd say, you have to publish on the site. They try to publish on the site. They couldn't do it. It was just such a disappointment for me that they weren't able to do it, but I didn't realize that it was my fault. And what I learned over the years was, and this is feeding into my first sponsor, Michael, to document my process. Now, the problem with documentation is people don't actually... If they were to read the documentation, if they were to see the process, they could get stuff done, but they don't do it. And you don't know whether they've done it or not. And so the team at Trainual said, you know what? A lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of businesses have that problem. They are really good at doing stuff. They're not good at passing the information on to other people. We're going to create software that will make it easier. They call it Trainual because it's like an online training manual. And what it does is it allows you to create your process in an organized, documented way, video, audio, text, whatever you need, images. You put it in there, and then you could pass it to other people on your team, and you could see when they've gone through the process, and you could see where they're stuck, where they're not completing it. Maybe you're just not explaining it well, and you can go in and help them out. Or you can see what they finish fast and understand that that is a really well-done process that you've documented for them. And so the Trainual people put this software together, and I said to them, well, why would I get that? Why would I really need it? Couldn't I just watch people as they're doing it or teach them by looking over their shoulder in Zoom? And they said, yeah, what happens when you change stuff? I go, oh yeah. What happens when I change stuff is I have to bring everyone together and make sure that they understand it. And Trainual said, no, if you change something, you could just update your manual and everyone who'd gone through that part of the manual now gets an alert saying that they need to go through this updated version, this updated part. And you know whether they've done it or not because you can see the progress that they've had. I'm explaining this when I should be actually telling people to go check it out for themselves. If you go to trainual.com/Mixergy, you will get to use this for yourself. If you're someone who's into documentation, this will blow you away. There's never been documentation software like this. If you've never documented, this is the best way to get started. Go to trainual.com, give them a shot, see for yourself how good this can be. You can also, once you get started with them, see my processes, the ones that we use to run my business in Trainual. So it's trainual.com/Mixergy. And for people who keep asking me to spell things out because I know, like a New Yorker, I talk too fast, it's trainual.com/Mixergy, trainual.com/Mixergy.
So I have a question for you now.
Yeah.
Did you do a read for Trainual before they jumped on board? Because that was marvelously. I can't even say it.
Thank
it
you.
Was
you
know so what I'm good that my tongue is being twisted into words because you just blew me away with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I did get on a call with them to make sure that I understood their product better than I could on my own. And truthfully, I was a little concerned because I didn't expect that they would be on the agenda for today. I was planning on reading them next week. And I looked and I said, all right, suck it up. You know this. And I just spoke without looking at my notes, just went for it. So I'm glad to hear that you said that.
That was beautifully done.
So
how much stock did you have in that company?
At what point did you give up the East Coast job and say, I'm going all in on this thing. I got this.
What was the first part of that? Sorry.
At what point did you go all in and say, you know what? I've got my new business. I'm not going to go back to the East Coast job.
So interesting thing happened. I'm working with my best friend. I have this side gig going on and everything. And my best friend, who's the president of the company, $11 million company at the time in New York, gets in a dispute with the owner over a house he was selling to the owner's daughter. Everything imploded from there. So basically, they wanted to get out of the sale. They ended up going to court. The owner of my company took the president of my company to court. President's my best friend. The owner grew up in our town as well. So when that all happened, which is crazy in itself, when that all happened, he basically fired him. He fired him. He was the president of the company fired over a house. Right. So at that point, I had a 6-month non-compete. My buddy had a 1-year non-compete. I stayed at the company for 6 more months. The whole deal was I was going to line my non-compete up with my best friend and we were going to open a company in New York. So I had 6 months to kill. So that's when I went to Utah. I was helping my ex-business partner get Parallel HR Solutions off the ground. The whole deal was I'm staying out there for 6 months and then I'm coming back to New York and opening this business with my best friend. So I go out there and right away I land a big client, Overstock.com. You familiar with Overstock?
I am, yeah.
Okay, great. So we start placing developers with them and we're doing really well. And she said, and I said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about staying. And she's like, okay, I'll give you 50% of the company and then we'll run this thing.
And your friend was going to give you 30%.
My buddy was going to give me 30%. So every decision I made was based on money at the time. And so it wasn't really a decision for me. It was very tough. I was very nervous about having the conversation with my buddy because he's my best friend and we've been planning this for years, but I had to do what I had to do. Little did I know that 50% of 5 million would not be nearly the same as 30% of 20 plus million.
Wow, and he did that much better and he was a better person for you to work with. Wow. And
I don't know. Yes, he did better. The businesses were different. Yeah, we built them different. Yes, he did better from a revenue standpoint. I don't know that it would have been the smartest thing to work with him because we were both alphas. We both wanted to be chiefs. And my friendship to him is way more important than any dollar amount in the world. And we're best friends to this day. So I'm glad that piece actually turned out the way it did. Because he ended up buying my company last year.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Okay, let's continue. Wow, that's pretty cool. Let's continue then with the story. You go out there, you get Overstock, you work out of their office, and this is really impressive. As you're walking around, talk about what you're doing that helps you drum up more business for yourself.
And I did this at every company I possibly could. I would just duck my head into people's offices and introduce myself. And, you know, those were the days where security wasn't like all over the place. So you could do that, you know, and you have a friend at a company let you in the door and you just roam the halls. And I'm just like, hi, are you so-and-so? Yeah, I've heard amazing things about you. You know, we provide staffing solutions, and I'd reference and leverage all the other managers I was working with.
Yeah.
And I would just introduce myself to these people, all the executives, of course. So then I would have meetings on the fly, and I would be able to drum up a lot of business, and I would walk in with really hot candidates with resumes and put them right in front of them. And, you know, I would just make it happen. Boom, boom, boom. And just get in there and, you know, get in one area and then leverage it throughout the entire organization. And that's really how I built the business and, you know, had success.
You know, I'm looking at an Internet Archive screenshot of what your site looked like in the beginning. You do healthcare, you do financial services, you do finance, you do functional IT, you do technical, you do like a lot of different things. Was there any focus, or was this just a whatever we can get, we're going to jump on and do?
I mean, at first it was whatever we can get. And then we did more finite, you know, as we had overstock, then I focused on more e-commerce companies, number one, but more companies that hired the same skill set as Overstock did. So that's why it didn't matter what industry they were in, because if they're hiring a Java developer, then I want to be able to take a candidate and market it to Overstock and then go to Goldman Sachs, which is in a completely different industry, but they're looking for the same core skill set and market that to Overstock and then Goldman Sachs, and then maybe go to IHC, which is a big healthcare system out there who's looking for the exact same skill set and market that same person there. So we want to, you know, make it easier on the recruiting team. So when they find a great candidate, then we can send it to four or five different companies, regardless of the industry. And if they didn't need to have industry specific experience, we would have a better opportunity of making a deal.
Got it. How's your addiction doing at this point in the story? Still addicted?
Oh, yeah.
Gambling.
No, I wasn't addicted to gambling. I'd stopped gambling. So actually 3 weeks ago when I released my book, Chasing the High, it was the week of my 14 years clean from gambling.
So wow. And you know what? I know how you got off of that, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Why don't we talk about how gambling was your first addiction, right? And how did you come into gambling?
My amazing uncle introduced me to it at Thanksgiving dinner. And
how?
So the family was congregating in one side of the house, as most do during Thanksgiving, but my uncle was glued in front of the TV. He was the only one there. So I was a little kid. I was 11 years old. So I ran over. I was wondering, what is he watching? Why is he so enthralled in this, television? And he was watching a football game, and he pulled this like sheet out of his pocket. And he showed it to me, and it was all the spreads, okay, for the football games. And for your audience, a spread is the line, like it would be 5, 6, 7, 8, the number of points a team would need to beat the other team, and you can bet on either team. And then, based on where the point spread landed, you would win. So he had showed me that he bet $10 on four games, and he won three of them. He needed to win all four to win his bet. And if he won this fourth game, that $10 would return $100. And I was just like, oh my God, that's the coolest thing in the world. And so he's like, if you borrow $10 from your parents, then, you know, you can fill one of these out too. So I ran over to my parents and I asked my my mom, and she said no. And I asked my dad, and I told him we were getting hoagies later that night, because that's what we called them back then in Massachusetts. They were hoagies.
Not sandwiches, not subs. Hoagies.
Hoagies, yeah. It was a Massachusetts thing, I think. And so he lent me the $10, and the worst thing that could have happened is I won. I bet on the four games, and I won that bet, and I won $100. And that started a 20-year gambling addiction.
I can't believe that you could suffer through the lows and still come back. Like, what's the most you lost as a gambler?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in total.
Was there one night that was especially bad? No.
No, I was addicted to the high of placing the bet. And I loved placing the bet. I got an extreme high of calling my
bet. The possibility was better than even winning.
Well, yeah. And I didn't win that much, to be frank. I mean, I was like the loser gambler who just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. Yeah, I won it from time to time. But overall, it was a big loss. So, you know, after I started gambling at 11, I worked for my father in his warehouse. The warehouse guys all gambled, so they would take my bets. Then my little league coach, he gambled, so he would take my bets. My little league coach, you know, this happens in Jersey. This is how Jersey is. And, you know, I would go down to the guys from work would take me to the Meadowlands racetrack. Wow. In New Jersey. My dad was about 30-minute drive from there, his office. So I would go there, and, you know, then we would start playing card games with all my friends. And I was the first one to have a job because I was a few months older than everybody. Outside of working for my dad, I got another job working at like his travel mart where I got to wear a cool visor. Not cool. And all my friends came in and made fun of me, but I was like a donut and newspaper stop.
And you take the money and use it to go gamble.
100%.
Wowee.
And then, I had a bank account before all my friends, and I would bring a checkbook to card games with my 16-year-old friends, and I would write a check for the whole pot. I would bet more than everybody because I had more money than everyone because I was working and they weren't yet, and I would put a check into the pot, and they're like, "What the hell is the matter with you?"
And you still couldn't buy the pot? Like, I would think that much money would scare them away.
Yeah, well, back then, that's what I did. I was like bullying.
You put in so much money that they can't keep up, and then you beat them because they can't go all in like you.
Exactly. And then that just kept going and going and going. And when I was in college, I was like, why gamble when you can be a bookie? And so I became a bookie.
Wow. And then at some point, you also started selling weed because you needed money. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even that I needed money. I just wanted money. Like, everything was money.
Why do you think you wanted money so badly?
I think I was very fortunate to grow up in a middle-class family. You know, my dad was successful, so I wanted to be successful, number one. But I had this vision in my mind from the movies, from all the media and everything, that if I was rich, everything would be fine. If I had money, I would have houses, I would have cars, the nicest suits, the nicest watches.
I get you said though everything would be fine. What do you think wasn't fine about you that you wanted to fix? Was it that you weren't good with people otherwise? Was it an insecurity? I know for me it was an insecurity.
I was great with people, you know, in high school.
Yeah, so then what do you think needed to be fixed?
Well, I was
go deep.
I mean, back then I think it was a status thing. It wasn't that I needed something fixed back then. Over the years, it was I was running away from certain problems. But back then, I was a college kid. And I wanted to be the big man on campus, that center of attention I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And that entrepreneur at the same time, because I had this entrepreneurial spirit. I just used it in the wrong ways. So when I went to college, I started going door to door selling home improvements. And I was selling roofing, siding, windows, decks, and I was like very successful doing that. But it was in some of the worst areas of the country, like Baltimore, Southeast Baltimore. I mean, like the murder capital of the country at the time. And I was still pretty successful doing it. And I just had no, like, I never thought of repercussions about anything that I did. There was no such thing as repercussions because I got away with everything, probably because, you know, I'm white and, you know, I borrow my dad's Lincoln Continental, like who's going to pull me over, right?
Yeah.
I could do this crazy shit and, you know, I probably wouldn't have been so fortunate if I was a minority. You know, that's just the facts. It is what it is.
So the way that this all stopped was you were riding in a car with your brother. You wanted to listen to the game because you needed it on Thanksgiving. Am I right?
Yeah, I was so gambling, the way gambling stopped.
Gambling, yeah.
It was after college. We were going up to Massachusetts for Thanksgiving again. I wanted to listen to the pregame reports so I could figure out who I was betting. My brother wouldn't let me listen to it. We argued back and forth. We put the radio on. We listened to the music for 3 hours. It was very peaceful and calm. I asked him, why can't you listen to sports radio? It's absurd. It's ridiculous. I thought it was the most outrageous thing I ever heard. And he's like, well, I'm going to GA. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, I'm going to Gamblers Anonymous. I'm like, what are you, a loser? Like, what do you mean you're going to Gamblers Anonymous? And so that was it. So after the ride, I thought to myself, wow, that was really calming and peaceful. And then I was like, I want to know what this Gamblers Anonymous did to my brother. Where is my brother? And so I went to a meeting. He didn't ask me. He didn't tell me I should go. I was just curious, and I just tapped into that curiosity and went to a meeting.
And so the first thing you thought was, these guys are losers.
Degenerate loser scumbags.
You just couldn't relate to them in any way, and you felt superior to them.
Initially, when I walked in the meeting, I felt superior to them. I'm like, are these guys kidding me? I'm in my 20s. I'm making six figures. Okay, I got nice suits on. I work in New York City. Like, I'm sitting here with a bus driver and a teacher and a mailman and a cop. I'm like, oh, these people are losers, right? And they lost all their money and they're in trouble with their wives. Like, I can't relate to these idiots, right? And by the end of those 2 hours, I realized I had more in common with every person that I was sitting around there than I did with my very best friends.
Because they would stand up, they would talk about what they were experiencing.
Yep. And why they were doing it and the internal pain they were going through and the isolation they were causing themselves and all of the things that weren't cool to talk about. The pain, the agony, the self-loathing, the feeling like the smallest person in the room, just things you wouldn't admit to your friends. And then I just was like, wow, I'm actually in the right place.
And you gave it up.
I gave it up. It wasn't that easy, but I had this guy get in my face. I was like answering these questions and kind of like lying to him. And he saw right through me. And I remember clear as day because he was like this close to me. And I remember like seeing him screaming at me, like thinking this guy's psycho. And like, he was so passionate that like the saliva from his mouth would like come out and like I would watch it land on my face.
I remember that from the book.
Like, I see it visually every day and I still talk to him actually. And he became my pseudo sponsor and I never gambled again. I worked the steps. I belonged to that meeting for years. I still go from time to time. When I moved out to Utah, the first thing I did, I was there my second day. I had no car still. And I got in a taxi. They didn't have Ubers and Lyfts back then. And they drove me to the VA because that's where the Gamblers Anonymous meeting was. And I walked in the second day there and made sure I got to a meeting because I was only clean about 2 years at that time. So I needed meetings still. And I got to that meeting. And then, you know, probably a few months later, I was leading the meeting and I led the meeting in Utah for 5 years.
Wow. Yeah, what a change. The other story is you're telling me that I remember is you having a hotel room at some hotel that had a casino. You drink, I guess, so much that you throw up on yourself?
Oh, yeah. That's a lovely visual for the audience. So I'm sure they're going to thank you after this story. But I was in Atlantic City, and I was gambling all night, and I was doing coke, and I was drinking. And I was playing blackjack. And I just didn't want to leave the table, but I knew I have a bad stomach as it is and I don't really drink that much. I never have. I didn't really like drinking, but I love doing coke and I love doing all the other stuff and drinking just kind of came with it. So I would have a few drinks, but I was getting sick and I was feeling really queasy and, you know, I was in the middle of a hand. I was betting two hands and it was like 4 or 5 in the morning. There weren't a lot of people in the casino even. Everybody was like sleeping who wasn't a addicted gambler. You could tell who they are because it's 5, 6 in the morning and they're still gambling. And I was one of them. And, you know, I was getting sick and I was like, I'll be right back. And I was running to the bathroom and I couldn't get there in time. And I pulled my shirt out and I threw up in my shirt.
Wow, man.
And I went into the bathroom and I like wiped down the shirt. I turned it inside out. I put it back on and I went back to the table and gambled for another couple hours.
Wow.
That's how sick I was. And I was doing coke at the same time, like I said.
And it was Gamblers Anonymous that got you out of the first addiction. And then from there, you were able to continue. You still stuck with the other addictions for a bit before you gave up the rest, right?
In my mind, like gambling was my only addiction because I did it every single day. Cocaine, I did on the weekends. I did it every weekend. So I mean,
and Adderall?
It was definitely an addiction. I didn't discover Adderall until I went to Utah. Okay. So at that point, I was still in New York. So I didn't know about Adderall. I knew about Ritalin, but I really only took Ritalin like when I needed to study 3 days in a row for college exams because I would miss half the classes dealing drugs and booking and partying and doing all this other nonsense.
Meanwhile, your business was growing. You opened up an office in India. Why?
Why hire one person when you can hire four for the price of one?
Why does a recruiting company like yours need people in India? What was their job going to be?
They were doing the same job that the people in the US were doing. They were recruiting.
Sourcing?
Recruiting candidates. They were actually, we trained them. So they would call candidates, they would screen them for tech jobs, and then they would send them over for approval for submittal to me, for instance, or other salespeople. And then we would submit them to the client, the same exact things our recruiters in the US were doing.
Really? They were actually staying up U.S. hours and starting to make calls and doing the whole thing?
They worked the night shift. So they worked the night shift over there. So they would work from like 7 p.m. to like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Okay.
And, you know, tons of, there's a huge business there of what they...
Yeah, I saw them on your website.
Yeah. And in the whole country, you know, the staffing is a big business that is in India and Philippines and all these different countries. And yeah, that's what they would do. So, you know, we could hire four for the price of one. So why not do that?
I wonder if what you needed, this is kind of feeding into my second sponsor, if you even had a second in command, like a COO, a general manager, VP of operations, did you have that?
Yeah, well, at the time I had a business partner. She's the one who opened in India. So I was here maintaining the clients. She was dealing with all the internal operations and delivery. So she
fell into what they were doing in India.
Exactly. So they were into the delivery side, which I'm sure your sponsor might be able to help with.
I'll talk about the second sponsor, which is COO Alliance. So get this. I'm running a marathon on every continent. I went to Australia to run a marathon. I said, as long as I'm here, I want to interview entrepreneurs. I interviewed this woman, Jane Liu. She runs an e-commerce clothing site called Shopo. $60 million in revenue, fully bootstrapped. This woman just wanted to figure out how she could sell clothing online, and she did it. And I said, well, how could you run it? You don't have much experience. Manufacturing is tough. E-commerce, all these things are tough. She said, you know what it is? I actually at one point just decided to book a trip to just get away from it all. She went to the Ultra Music Festival. I said, interesting. How did the company do while you were away? She said, I felt a lot of guilt. I couldn't really afford it, but I did it. I said, when you came back, did the company kind of fall apart and you had to pick it up again? She said, no. The company actually did better. I said, how did it do better? She said, well, I got this this woman to come in and be my second in command. She started running this business. She ended up running it way better than I did because she's such an organized person. Jane told me that every time that she had an idea for like how to run things by seat of the pants, this woman who was essentially her chief operating officer, her COO, would pick up the pieces and organize it and, despite Jane's wishes at times, make the company more orderly and help it grow. And so what that helped me realize is the power and the importance of hiring the right second in command. Now, what we do is when we hire somebody, we sometimes give them training, right? So you hire a SEO person, maybe you sign them up for SEO training or you get them SEO software, whatever. What do you do with the second in command? Well, it turns out there aren't a lot of organizations for the second in command to go to get help. So this guy, Cameron Harold, who built 1-800-GOT-JUNK as their COO, as their second in command, into, I think, a $100 million plus operation, who built other businesses by growing them as the chief operating officer, said, you know what? I'm going to create it. This is the time in my life where I'm going to create it. He created the COO Alliance. You people, if you've heard my interviews, have heard me go to him when I was trying to figure out who to hire, and I ended up hiring a great VP of operations thanks to his guidance. Well, if you want that type of help for your COO, give them the guidance, give them the mentoring, give them the team of people that they could work with. Let them work with Cameron Harold, who is at this point by far the number one COO trainer, number one COO, like, what's the word for it? I don't know if like the person that COOs, the person second in commands go to, if you want that, you should go to COOalliance.com/Mixergy. Just get them in touch with Cameron. He will help them out. And if it's not a good fit, you guys don't need to work with him. But if it is, it's going to be life-changing for them. So you're going to give them a gift, and it's going to be life-changing for your business in ways that you probably not only couldn't anticipate, but in ways that you probably as an entrepreneur, as a COO, would resist. He is that good. This organization is that good. And the right COO is that good. Go to COOalliance.com/Mixergy. Let's continue here, Michael. Why are you holding your mic, by the way? Are you not sitting at a desk?
I moved for you, remember?
All right. And so now you have no desk and you're holding it for an hour.
Hey, I'm here to please you. So whatever you need. You need me to do a cartwheel? It'll hurt, but I could probably do it.
Thanks. I appreciate that you've got the energy to keep doing it.
No problem.
You mentioned earlier that she fell in love with someone. She was in India. Is that where she fell in love with whoever it was that was working with you?
Yeah, my ex-business partner you're talking about? Yeah, no, she started having an affair with one of the three directors in India, you know, unbeknownst to us. Now, she was married and she had two kids.
And so she was doing this? Uh-huh.
Behind her back. So like when I bought the company from her, I had no idea this was happening until we went over there and transitioned the company. We had this big company party. At the end of the party, like, and she drank a lot. It was very emotional for her because, you know, she thought this was her company. And this is why it was hard for her to let it go and for me to buy it. At the time we were fighting nonstop.
Why? Like
I'll take you through what got up to that time. I was working longer and longer. She was working less and less. She thought she set up the infrastructure of the company, so she's done. I don't need to work hard. So she's working like 6 hours a day wanting to spend more time with her kids. And I'm all for spending more time with your kids, but not at my expense, not if we're 50-50 partners. So, you know, I told her, fine, you want to work less, then we're not splitting things 50-50. She obviously wouldn't have anything to do with that. So she wanted to work her 6 hours and I'm working 10, 12 hours managing all the clients. But I needed her. Because when we had new employees, she was the best recruiter. So I needed her to train them, and she didn't really want to. So that's where we started butting heads. I wanted to continue to build the company. She was happy at where it was. And we eventually weren't talking to each other, hated each other. Our offices were right next to each other, and we would not speak to each other. It was very volatile. It was very tense. It was very angry. It was very emotional. And it was driven by both of our egos. My ego drove me for years, ego and money. So eventually we went to our own lawyers and we had our lawyers negotiate a buyout between the two of us.
Where you knew you would be the one to buy out because you're the one who was more committed to spending time at the company. You agreed to spend how much money to buy her out?
Well, I didn't know, but my mentality going into it, and hers was too, she wanted the company. She wanted me to leave.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I positioned it in a way that I was able to, you know, buy her out because I had all the relationships with the clients. I said, this doesn't make any sense. Like, you're going to buy the company. You don't even have relationships with the clients. I do. So that's kind of how I was able to leverage that. And I bought, you know, we agreed on $1.35 million. And again, we were doing 5.5 at the time or 5 or whatever it was. And I paid her $1 million up front, which I didn't have. What's that?
Yeah. How'd you get the million?
I had saved about half of it. So I had half of it, and then I borrowed the other half.
Is that the Chase loan?
No, the Chase loan came after. I actually borrowed it from my father. So
wow.
So he gave me $500,000 loan over 7 years. And the first year or two, I think it was the first year or two, was interest only. So that was great. So it gave me an opportunity to get on my feet and make these payments and everything like that. And at that time, I wanted to expand back into New York. So immediately after I bought her out, I had already started expanding into New York. And that's when I got the Chase line because I needed that money to bring a whole payroll on in New York, bring like a director on, an SVP. Like I hired some big time people in New York and it ended up blowing up in my face. Because at the same time, a lawsuit started with her and I find out she's violating the agreement.
Who sued who? There's a whole chapter about this in the book.
Yeah. So she sued me. So, it was 1.35, paid her $1 million up front. Within 2 months of that, I found out that she was in fact having an affair with one of the directors in India. I needed this guy. I was counting on this guy, you know, to run the office there. She was over there taking him to the Maldives, doing all this stuff. And right after, the office in India, which was a $1 million producing office, started tanking. And I didn't have the loyalty of the India people. She did. because she went over there multiple times. I had just met them at the sale. So, you know, it was crazy. So basically she had their loyalty. She ended up taking 9 of the 14 employees out and staffing them at another company. And it was like a coup basically where she was setting up her own company on the outside of it in violation of our agreement. And wow. So I held off on the next payment, told her we were doing an internal investigation, and she sued me.
And how'd the lawsuit shake out?
very, very bad. Very bad. It's a 6-year ordeal. 6 years of lawsuit. It basically cost me over $1 million.
Really?
Over $350K, and it cost me over $1 million.
Do you think you could have just given her $350, and if you would have given her the extra $350 and just suffered through it, you would have been better off?
Woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Wow. Okay.
100%. The lawyers, I ended up actually hating my lawyers worse than the feelings I had towards her. My lawyers, I felt, were bilking and milking me. Milking or bilking, whatever.
Bilking. Bilking. Both actually work.
Both. Yeah. And, you know, 6 years, I went to trial, actually. I was on the stand 5 times. The jury actually awarded in my favor. However, so they awarded that I actually owed her the $350 because I signed an agreement, but that she caused $260K in damages through her actions. So it was a net $90K, but the judge awarded her as the party that won. So that meant I owed attorney's fees. Now this is 6 years of attorney's fees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So now she's trying to recoup like $500,000-$600,000 in attorney's fees.
She still is.
No, she was at the time.
She was.
So we were going back and forth. The attorneys couldn't agree on attorney's fees. The judge wouldn't certify the ruling until that was agreed upon. And it was just a nightmare. So after 8 months, after the trial ended, they still couldn't agree on it. And I'm like, forget this. I'm like, I need to just come up with an agreement with her. Like, I have to move on with my life. It was destroying me. It was absolutely destroying me emotionally, mentally, financially, everything. I felt completely stuck. I was miserable. I was isolated. I was, smoking pot every day. I was just, I was just a miserable human at the time. And so I ended up negotiating a settlement with her for $350, the same amount I owed her 6 years earlier.
Wow.
That is how my life works.
Was this your ex? Oh, okay. All right. So who was it who called? Your best friend called her up and tried to work things out with her. And is he the one who made that deal?
Yeah.
He was. Wow.
Unbeknownst to me. Yeah. He's the one who got everything, the ball rolling and everything.
So I went through Glassdoor because that's how I research people. And here's what I saw. 2017, just 2 years ago, I worked for, here we go. The headline of this one is "The CEO Needs to Go." I thought maybe it's not Michael.
It is.
I'm reading through it. It said the CEO, Michael Dash, very clearly, a horrible leader. His customers are leaving in droves. A few customers he has left are only with him because they're drinking buddies. He feels okay to speak behind people's back and to put the blame on his failing business on anyone else but himself. Is this true, all the stuff that I'm reading about you on Glassdoor?
I would say not all of it. I would say probably 75% is definitely true.
It is.
Yeah. So if you know Glassdoor, just as a precursor, you can comment every year for up to 5 years after you're done with employment. So some of those comments are from the same people. My ex-business partner, her sister worked for me.
I was going back and updating
brother-in-law. Yes. However, that's a small portion of it. I had a very bad time in New York when I tried to expand into New York, and I was under a lot of stress, and I did not treat the employees properly. I didn't run it properly, basically. I just totally botched the whole thing. I was hopped up on Adderall. I had, I was in the middle of this lawsuit. I was fighting with my attorneys, fighting with my ex-business partner. I was paying back these loans to Chase Bank, paying back a loan to my father, and managing 3 offices at the same time. None of those are an excuse for my behavior, but I was an ego-driven maniac. And, the way I treated and reacted to situations was not from a place of empathy and mentorship. And a lot of it was the Adderall would just flip a switch with me. And if a client yelled at me, instead of like taking it and learning from it, I would take that and yell at my employees. So it was like transferring the client's anger through me to the employees, when at the end of the day, I should have managed it a lot better. I should have talked it out. I should have not micromanaged. I should have allowed leadership to do their jobs. But I was under a lot of pressure. And
how'd you turn this around? How'd you get to a place where you could get past it?
Very, very through a lot of lessons learned.
Just you suffering and spending the time learning lessons. Do you actually sit down and journal through it, or how do you actually extract the lesson?
So I went to Bali and I went to this retreat called Unconventional Life. And it's an amazing retreat of eclectic people from around the world who are all in different areas. So there's some corporate people, there's some healers, there's energy people, there's digital nomads, there's entrepreneurs. So there is a subsection of everything in this group where I'd never been exposed to a lot of these people. While I was there, there were two people talking about flow and living in a state of flow. Mm-hmm. A process of following your intuition, of making decisions by following your intuition. And if it's not a hell yes, it should be a fuck no. And you could bleep that out if you need to. Okay. Nope. And that is the whole premise of it, right? And I had never heard of this before. And then I called bullshit on them. I said, this is nonsense, because they were telling about all these crazy stories. They were in corporate America and they weren't happy, but they were successful. And, you know, they didn't feel like they were living their, you know, what they were meant to do on this earth, and blah, 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 all the nonsense you hear. At the time, I thought it was all nonsense. And, you know, they were telling me how their lives changed and they started studying flow, and they were being invited all over the world to speak on this for free and being put up here and there, and they're meeting Richard Branson and all these other people. And I'm just like, this is bullshit. You know, I'm like, get out of here. And so I called them on it. I resisted it hard because that's the state of mind I was in, until they said to me, you know, or I raised my hand and I said, look, I've been in this awful lawsuit. I can't get out of my own way. I'm miserable right now. I think what you're saying is bullshit. And they said, let's talk after the session. So I talked to them after the session. They told me about this course that they have, and it's $1,000. And I immediately thought, scam. This is a scam. You know, they want my money, and they're going to teach me some nonsense that doesn't even work. But when I left it, I was in so much pain. I was in so much misery at that time. You know, employees all over hating me, right? Business was kind of, you know, I still had clients, but we weren't really doing great. We were down to like maybe 3 million, 3.5 million from 5.5 million. So we were, you know, going down. I had shrunk my staff. You know, I had like this lawsuit that was hanging over me. I had these loans that were going crazy. I had these addictions that were out of control. So it was really a chaotic life. And I just thought to myself on the plane ride back from Bali, would it be so bad to live a different way? And I sat with that one sentence over and over and over. And I said, I'm going to push everything aside. All my preconceived notions about people who taught flow and energy and astrology and healing, everything I learned from back east, that these people are shishi nonsense, don't believe it. I pushed it to the side and I said, I'm just going to take the course and I'm going to drop my ego for the first time in my life and see what happens. And I took this course and we went through a process of clearing out our limiting beliefs through tapping and EMDR. I'm not sure if you're familiar with
this. Not EMDR, but I've heard of tapping, yes.
So EMDR is like you're moving your eyes back and forth from one side to the other. You're tapping at the same time. You're repeating these
tapping, limiting beliefs. You're doing the back of your neck and you're moving your eyes back and forth.
Exactly.
What's the tapping for?
It basically hits this nerve, that releases some sort of energy.
Okay. And that's for people who are listening, the back of your neck. Okay. And you're supposed to say something.
And like, so like take a limiting belief that change is difficult, right? As a simple one, right? So you're just repeating change is difficult, moving your eyes back and forth and tapping here. And they actually told me, once you do this, you're going to be physically exhausted. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I just ran 4 marathons. Give me a break. You know, I'm not going to be physically exhausted. So, but I said, I'm just going to do it. And you write all this out, by the way, as well. So I had written it all out. I was doing all this, and all of a sudden, and then you put, you release the limiting belief, and then you put in a positive belief. So like, change is difficult to change is easy, right? So you're replacing it with a positive belief. So I did all this other and I was physically and emotionally exhausted after it. I actually had to lay down, and all I was doing is sitting, tapping, and moving my eyes back and forth and speaking. And things started changing in my life. I was able to start manifesting solutions to the problems that I had, when all I was doing before was trying to logically think of all these solutions, but none of them were happening for me. I was all of a sudden starting to manifest things. And the word manifestation was never in my vocabulary. I never said it once before I met these people.
Like what? What were you manifesting?
So, for instance, I was a person who needed to plan every single trip that I ever took. Okay. Months in advance, I would need the hotel. I would need the flight. I would need the car. I would need everything. Right.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay. And they told me they never planned this stuff. They were planning like a couple of days before, a week before, and things would manifest themselves based on them speaking about what they were doing, and people would connect with them and all this stuff. And I said, all right, let me try this nonsense out. So I was going to South by Southwest. And if your audience is familiar with that, it's a huge conference for tech, movies, and music, and held in Austin every year. And I would go every year, and I would plan months in advance, and I didn't plan anything. And maybe like a week before, I was like, all right, you know what? I started calling around to my friends. I'm like, you guys going? They're like, yeah. I'm like, where are you staying? And they're like, oh, yeah, everybody was booked or nobody had a place. So I'm like, let me call my friend down there and let me just see if he knows anybody. 2 days before, I call my friend. I'm like, hey, I'm coming down for South by. I don't have like a ticket or a place to stay or a car or anything. Do you like know anybody? He's like, man, you must have some amazing intuition, because last night I booked a flight for my whole family. I'm taking them all to Hawaii. I'm taking them out of town. You can stay at my 3,500 square foot place.
Wow. It's hard even months in advance to find a place in Austin for South by.
It's impossible. It's impossible. So he's like, you can stay there for a week. I'll do you one better. I just got a brand new Mercedes truck. You can use the truck as much as you want. And my office happens to be, because he was a lawyer, my office happens to be right on the strip where all the events happening. I have a parking pass for you. You can use that also. All you have to do is feed my gerbil. And so my response, of course, was, you have a gerbil? So, you know, I went, I fed his gerbil, I stayed there, it all fell into place for me. He actually had a free ticket to some of the events as well.
Wow. All of this stuff. And you're saying this is the type of stuff that happens to you now because you're manifesting, because you've changed your outlook from limiting beliefs to more empowering beliefs. Let me close this out with two things. Following your intuition. Let me close it out with two things, because we've got another guest coming on. We're doing this whole thing live here today. I want to understand what happened to Parallel HR Solutions. You've been running this recruiting company. It was going down. How did you turn things around so that you can sell it? Or did you turn it around so you can sell it?
I basically sold it. I mean, it was kind of at a plateau. It was kind of doing like $3.5 million. Mm-hmm. And you know, I sold it at that level. So I sold it for a discount from what it
was. Did you get enough money to pay back your dad and to pay back Chase?
So yeah. So I basically, what happened is I wanted to settle the lawsuit and pay the lawyer bills off and pay my father off. I had paid the Chase and pay the Chase loan off, pay it all off and reset my life. So that's what I did.
How much did you end up personally at the end of all that nonsense?
What's that?
How much did you end up with personally at the end of this whole run? Anything?
No.
No, so, no money. So you're back to zero.
No, I mean, I have some money. I had four houses, right? Through that, I invested in houses and stuff. So I sold those houses. So I got a few hundred grand from those houses.
Okay.
But that's it. Everything else I sold.
About $500,000 in the bank that now you could start your new life off with.
No, I don't have $500,000. But 200? Yeah.
200. Got it. But no more obligations for work, no more obligations for anything except to tell people, here's how you turned your life around and they could too. How did you get off of the other drugs? We kind of closed it by saying that you got off of gambling and that was the first step out. What did you do to finally get rid of everything else?
So they're interesting. So, I mean, the cocaine, I actually was in New York City. My friend got in a fight. I went to break up the fight and I actually got hit from the side and broke my nose. And after I got my nose fixed, they handed me a bill and it was $10,000. And I looked at the bill and I said, I will never put another thing up this $10,000 nose again. And that's how I quit cocaine. Dead serious. I lost you. I can't hear you.
Sorry. Just cold turkey.
Cold turkey.
Wow.
Okay. I already knew the principles of what I needed to do to quit something.
Because did you go through the 12 steps on your own?
I didn't. I just quit cold turkey. I hated the drug, actually. So I quit. I didn't do it every day. I just hated it.
Okay.
It was easy for me to quit. Adderall was different. Adderall was much, much more challenging. You know, I've been off that for over a year now. It's definitely affected my level of energy level, for sure. I drink a lot more coffee than I used to, but I'm a much more empathetic person. I actually lead from a leadership place. I've always been a leader. I always did a lot of philanthropic things besides my company, gave back a lot, you know, raised over $100,000 for Leukemia Lymphoma Society, all that stuff. But I basically had ran out of Adderall at my office. I couldn't get it. I'm going to condense this story. I couldn't get it for 3 days. 3 days working with my staff, they were like, are you okay? They're like, you seem like a different person. We were managing and coming up with solutions to any of the challenges we had. And it was much more flowing conversation and a much better interaction with all of my employees. And I decided, you know, I don't need this anymore. It's turning me into somebody I am not. And so that's how I gave it up, because I realized, like, I can manage things. I can mentor people from a lot more of a empathetic space, okay, and a leadership space without this drug. And I don't ever want it in my life again.
Wow. And so now you're drug free completely?
I mean, I dabble once in a while with marijuana, but I don't buy or purchase or have anything, any marijuana in my place.
Sohan, who's listening,
I'm not gonna sit here and say no. Never with Adderall, never with cocaine, never with gambling. The things I was addicted to, I will never do again.
Weed, alcohol.
Yeah, once in a while though, but I don't like seek these things out. So if I'm somewhere and it's around and I'm like, let me have a hit, I will. But it's nothing that I seek out and it's nothing that I yearn for. These other, though, they were not like addictions that ran my life like these other things did.
Sohan in the audience is asking, what's the URL of that intuition program that you mentioned?
So it's actually in the book on page 107.
Let me see if this Kindle version of your book is giving me the stupid location numbers that Amazon created. I love Amazon for everything except that they insist on location number. I'm now on location number 1531. What does that even mean?
I have no idea, but you could just go and chasingthehighbook.com and it'll take you to, you can buy the Kindle version or the paperback version. On page,
I got the Kindle version. I'm not messing with paper.
Hopefully everybody else likes paper. But Kindle's great too. On page 107, I have in the book, Justin and Jackie talk about flow principle number 3, which is follow your intuition at all times. If you want to learn more about that after you buy my book, you can go to flow-mastery.com. So that's flow-mastery.com. And you could contact Jackie and Justin. They're very good friends of mine. Tell them you heard me and they'd be glad to speak to you more about their program. I will highly, highly recommend it. It changed my perspective on everything. It changed my life.
And Michael has a very easy to spell name. You can check out his website at michaelg-.com. And I want to thank you for doing this interview, Michael. I like the book. I like hearing your stories here, but I also love reading them too in the book.
Great. And can I mention one more thing?
Yeah, yeah.
So I might have mentioned it earlier just to you, but so I sold my business. I changed my whole life so I could focus on helping entrepreneurs and business leaders who are dealing with addictive and compulsive behaviors that are affecting them as leaders in their company, family members, as friends, like they did to me. I can relate to them. I can relate to making a decision every 15 minutes of the day for 10 hours straight and wanting to escape. And so if anybody's interested in learning more about that program, I built a free webinar, which you can find at michaelg-.com/flow. Excuse me. /fate. Sorry.
F-A-T-E.
F-A-T-E, which stands for From Addict to Entrepreneur. So michaelg-fate. It's a free webinar, 45 minutes. You can learn more about my program.
I'm on the page now. All right. And his last name is Dash. We're not talking about the punctuation. michaelg-.com/fate. All right. I want to thank two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you're trying to train your people, get them up to speed using your documentation, go check out Trainual. Specifically, if you get trainual.com/mixergy, they'll give you a discount, 30%. They'll also show you the documentation that we use to run our company and the interview that I did with the founder. Trainual.com/mixergy, really organizing your company that way will change the way your company functions. And second, if you have a second in command, go check out COOalliance.com/mixergy. Michael, thanks so much for being on here.
It's been great. Have a great rest of the day.
You too.